Journalist and novelist Carl Hiaasen is our guest today on the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. In addition to being a columnist for the Miami Herald, Hiaasen is the author of 9 novels. His latest is Basket Case. The protagonist in Basket Case is Jack Tegger, once a hotshot investigative reporter. Now he sits at his newspaper's obituary desk. The paper, the Union Register, is owned by a publicly traded corporation called Magid Feist Publishing Group. The CEO, one Race Magid III. Our hero, Jack Tegger, has been banished to writing obits because of some pointed remarks he made at a meeting of shareholders for the publisher. Then along comes a chance for Tegger to rise again. On his watch at the obit desk, a famous former rock and roll star, the lead guy in the band Jimmy Stoma and the Slut Puppies, dies under suspicious circumstances in the Bahamas. Carl Hiaasen's previous novels include Sick Puppy, Striptease, and Double Whammy. He's also the author of a book of nonfiction on Disney titled Team Rodent, How Disney Devours the World. His new book, Basket Case, published by Knopf. Listeners, your questions and comments are invited. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Carl Hiaasen, good afternoon. Welcome.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us this afternoon. So tell us about the name for this this famous former rock and roll star character, Jimmy Stoma and the Slut Puppies.
The Slut Puppies. Well, actually, I'd never heard that phrase before until my wife used it in an unflattering reference to some of the male species, and I picked up on the meaning, but I thought it sounded great. It had a nice lyrically cynical quality that I thought would go good with a band from the 80s.
Very good, very good. And the title of the novel comes from a Jimmy Stoma tune called Basket Case.
Right. I'm sure it could be autobiographical as well, but it's also the name of a song.
And that song from the fictional Jimmy Stoma is going to appear. It's a real song now.
Yeah, this is another strange twist. I had already finished the novel, and the title was on the book, obviously, and everything, and I had rather shamelessly approached a friend of mine, Warren Zevon, who's a great songwriter and a great musician, and I just sort of whimsically asked him if I had lyrics through a lot of Jimmy's fictitious songs throughout the novel, but I hadn't really finished one of the songs, and I asked Warren if he'd help me finish it and if he could actually record something that would have sounded like it came from a big band of the 80s, you know, thinking he would sensibly say no and send me on my way. But he was intrigued by the idea because he told me he'd never done a cover song for a novel before. So he has a home studio, and he did it, got some great musicians, and he did the song just as a favor to me. And then his label ended up liking it so much they're going to put it on his album. But it really was started as a favor. I was just sort of capitalizing on our friendship. I just thought it would be something funny to have.
Yeah. Will there be a video?
God, I hope not. No, it's pretty retro. I mean, you know, we made it as offensive as we possibly could in the spirit of the times.
Yeah, well, I thought we would play a bit of it here.
All right, you're very brave.
Okay, here's Basket Case, and this is going to appear on Warren Zevon's forthcoming CD, My Ride's Here. Basket Case from the forthcoming compact disc, My Ride's Here,
yeah.
Warren Zevon.
Very sensitive ballad.
Yes, yes. Leather and Lace, Basket Case. When is My Rides Here due out?
I think it'll be April, I believe. Yeah. I'm not sure. The record business works in strange ways. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Well, so does the publishing business, I'm sure. So has there ever been another novel out there that you know of that has a musical tie-in?
I don't know. I don't know. I don't think so. None that I've ever heard.
Yeah.
None that I ever heard. Certainly, this was just some sort of complete, impulsive move on my part. But I certainly haven't heard of any. I could think of somewhere it might be useful.
Yeah.
It'd be nice to have a musical tie into Moby Dick or something.
Oh, well, let's talk a little bit about the story of Basket Case. Maybe you'd tell us about the story's protagonist, Jack Tagger.
Well, Jack is a middle-aged journalist like myself, and he entered the business in the heady times of Woodward and Bernstein and Watergate, and went in with a lot of idealism. And his career arc has not been exactly the stuff of legends. He's working at a kind of small to medium-sized daily in Florida. And he is doing some investigative work, and then he makes the mistake of going to a shareholders meeting of the company that owns his newspaper. And Jack boldly stands up and confronts the CEO of the company about all the cost-cutting and the changes that have come to the newspaper just sort of by stripping it down to save money. And he does this in a very heroic way that gets him bumped immediately down to the obituary beat, which is not a good place to be when you're in middle age.
Mm-hmm.
You shouldn't be writing about dead people every day at a point in your life when you're starting to think about it a little too much anyway. So the beat, working in the obituary beat, has really worked on Jack's head in not in a good way. And he knows he's got to get. He wants to get back on the front page. He wants to get back to writing real news stories again. And he figures. All he needs is, in his own words, is a famous stiff. And in this case, along comes Jimmy Stoma, and Jack thinks he's got a mystery on his hands and also a way out of his predicament.
Yeah. So he's not going to roll over. He's going to fight his way out.
No, I mean, he's an idealist, but I mean, as much as anybody can be idealistic after spending, a career in journalism of any kind. I mean, it's not a profession that lends itself to sunny optimism, but he does believe that the readers deserve better than they're getting from the company that owns his newspaper, and he's tired of seeing positions slashed and the news hole shrunk and a lot of things that are really happening to papers all over the country today. And so this is his little way of fighting back, and it's his own private little war, and he's not a quitter. And I kind of like him, and he certainly thinks about things in some ways like I do. But this was the first novel I'd ever done, that was in the first person, and it was a little unusual, and it took a little time for me to get used to being inside one character's skull for the whole story.
Mm. And this man, Jack Tagger, this character, he's about the same age you are?
I think he's a little bit younger. I think he's 46 in the novel, and I'm 48. So when I started the novel, we were probably the same age. Through the miracle of fiction, he hasn't aged at all.
Yeah. Well, given that there's another character by the name of Emma, who's Jack's boss, and she's so much younger,
right.
I'm sure this is not only happening in the news business, but it's happening all over the place. But she's somebody who doesn't have any experience and doesn't have the store of knowledge and history that Jack does. And he's this middle-aged guy who's been busted down to, something where most reporters... or not most, but reporters might begin their career at the obituary desk.
Right, yeah. Right. So he's got a particular amount of resentment for that, and plus he's working for a very young editor, and if you've ever been in a newsroom, you'll know that older reporters always despise younger editors and distrust them, and he sort of carries that attitude in, and yet in a way he's got to recruit Emma. If he's going to chase this story, the Jimmy Stoma story, and has any chance at all of getting it on the front page, he's going to need her help, and he realizes this along the way. And he actually finds out that she's a lot smarter and sharper than he gives her credit for.
Mm-hmm. His concerns about newspapers, the concerns that lead him to say something brief but shockingly coarse before that group of investors, how are they on the money? Is what he says to those investors the case in newspapers today, in the business today?
Well, I mean, yeah, they're shrinking. They're getting thinner and dumber by the day because most of them now are owned by corporations whose first allegiance is to stockholders, not to the readers. And the best way to jack up the price of a newspaper is to spend less and less money putting it out, and that means spend less money on gathering news, which is, after all, our jobs. But it's happening, and you can hear complaints from coast to coast. You can walk into the any newsroom, big or small, and see it happening, and see, you know, pick up a newspaper today and pick up the same paper 20 years ago, and I promise you, it's going to be thinner and more full of gimmicks than actual news. And you know, the first things to go are usually the investigative jobs because those are expensive projects. You go out, you know, you're chasing corruption. It doesn't happen overnight. It can take a long time, and at the end of the story, you may not have anything to put in the paper. And many papers don't do much investigative reporting. They do a lot of celebrity news now. You've got no end to the amount you can read on Britney Spears. But the Enron story wasn't exactly broken by a major media outlet. It was a bankruptcy proceeding that emanated out of a company that had ripped people off, and nobody really got hold of it until it was too late. So there's a lot of great journalism still being done in this country, but it's being done in spite of the people that own most of the big newspaper chains.
Yeah. Well, some of the people that own big newspaper chains came to newspapering through entertainment. Fox, Disney, some of the big companies are entertainment companies at the heart of it.
I think there's that, and the fact that, again, you have to answer to Wall Street when you should be answering to your readers. I mean, that's the thing people don't understand. It's popular to bash the press, and certainly we deserve a good bit of it, but the fact is that nobody becomes a newspaper reporter because they're going to get rich or they're going to get famous, because neither happens to you. You go in knowing you're not going to get paid very well, and only your mom is going to notice your byline on the story. Nobody reads the bylines or pays attention to them. So you're going in it because you believe that in the cause of putting the truth in the paper and delivering the truth to people that have no other way of getting it. And once that is violated, once that becomes damaged by what's essentially just corporate greed, then you have a reason to get mad, and readers have a right to know. You have to understand that some of these companies, the profit margins they're demanding of the papers they own are astronomical. They're upwards of 23, 24, I've heard of 25% being demanded at some companies. Those are astonishing profit margins in any industry. There's a line in the book where Jack says, you know, he knows crack dealers would be happy with 25% net profits. And so for them to say that the business is dwindling and strangling if we don't cut positions, yeah, it is if you ask for those kinds of profits. Certainly it's going to strangle. But most companies get by on a lot less than that. So, you know, we're talking about an incredible, you know, fountain of greed that's sort of feeding this trend. And so Jack has a reason to be mad, and he has a reason to be feisty and a little bit, cantankerous.
Mm. When you write your column for the Miami Herald, do you find yourself angry? There's some anger there, but yet you also have this tremendous sense of humor about things. You really poke people satirically.
Well, that's sort of just the style that's evolved. Yeah. I mean, certainly the novels are supposed to be funny, but they're supposed to be funny with a point. And the columns, it obviously depends on the material. It depends on what you're writing about on any given day. Sometimes they're going to be funny columns because, you know, that you just can't resist. You know, when we have regular pageantry of corruption in South Florida. So on any given week, somebody's getting let off in handcuffs from City Hall. And it's hard not to make fun of that because it becomes comical. On the other hand, there are certain subjects that you'd never treat that way, and you have to treat with more of a serious view. And the column is much different. You know, you mix up your pitches from one to the other. The novel sort of sustain a satirical and a very sharp comic tone because humor is a tremendous weapon when you're writing satire. I mean, if you look at, and I'm not by any means putting myself in the same league with it, if you go back to Twain and Mencken and everyone who wrote funny, funny stuff, it came from a real well of anger and outrage about something, a social condition in this country. And satire has always been an effective and a very lacerating weapon, and it's one I enjoy using to great effect. And it's a great it's a great high to be able to make people laugh at something you've written at the same time knowing they get what you're trying to say. They get the point.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the beauty of a column or of an editorial cartoon as well.
Exactly.
Yeah. You mentioned the Enron story a couple of minutes ago. What do you think about that story and how it's been reported to date?
Well, I think it's going to get bigger and bigger. It's like any brewing scandal. Each day, and today on the Times, New York Times, there's a whole other, you know, another scab that's picked open because we find out that some of these clowns were out of these phony companies, the phony partnerships they set up, making huge amounts. One guy turned $5,800 investment into $1 million in 3 weeks of somebody else's money, of course. So this is just going to get uglier and uglier. But when you're dealing with a private corporation, you have to peel back the layers slowly. It's not like Watergate, where you had, you know, ostensibly a constitutional right to know a lot of this stuff. A private companies can hide behind all kinds of lawyers and legal artifices that prevent the information from coming out. But I certainly wasn't surprised that Mr. Kenneth Lay did not make himself available to Congress this week. I mean, he's got a lot of problems that are going to be around a long time, and all of which he would seem to richly deserve.
Mm. You've written quite a bit about corruption and ethics in columns for the Miami Herald. What's the latest on ethics training for public employees and metropolitan
Yeah, we
Miami?
Have one of the, you know, what we have a great system in South Florida. South Florida is basically so crooked that they decided in Miami-Dade County that they had to give all employees a lesson, ethics seminars, to sort of explain them, this is right, this is wrong. No, you can't take cash for your job from a private citizen. You know, sort of explaining the basics of bribery and graft so there wouldn't be any fuzziness or ambiguity about it with these folks. And now we have a county manager who's decided that he doesn't need to take the test himself, and there certainly seems to be indications that he might be well advised to take it 2 or 3 times. But that's the kind of place we live. Florida is great for this kind of stuff, and great in the sense of providing material if you're writing a column, or certainly for the novels. In my case, the journalism and the material that appears on the front page of the Miami Herald certainly becomes great fodder for use later in the books. I'm lucky to live in a place like this where some days it's like shooting fish in a barrel.
You wrote a column about a woman who apparently did get the ethics training course, talking about the pitch going back and forth. The city's aviation director, who actually seems to be like the kind of person you'd want in public life, a woman by the name of Angela Gittens, and she got in trouble for criticizing the influence of private lobbyists.
Right. She was upset. She came from Atlanta, where she ran Hartsfield Airport, and they brought her in to run Miami International Airport, which is year in and year out rated one of the worst airports in America. And, you know, it's not an unusual week when they're rounding up baggage handlers for rifling through luggage. And all the concessions there have been pieced out to friends of politicians so that when you buy a hot dog, somebody's getting money that's going down the line. It's a pretty tawdry operation. And she was hired ostensibly to clean it up, and she was a little upset that the lobbyists seemed to have more access than she did to certain information into certain politicians, and she said so. And so she was called in and lectured about not playing the game. So, you know, and again, it's shooting fish in a barrel. You have someone who's brought in with an honest reputation trying to do her job, and she's immediately called in and lectured by the administration down there about not being respectful enough to this fine, upstanding group of lobbyists we got. You know, 5 minutes with whom any of them you'd want to have to take a hot shower and an acid bath.
Mm. Count your fingers, as they say.
Yes.
Shaking hands. So it seems that taxpayers and the poor manatee are the only ones in Florida without lobbyists.
That's right. Yeah, it's just, as I said, it's one of those places where all you have to do is wait about 30 seconds for a new story to come along. There's something, again, ironic about it all, because if in a better world, a lot of this stuff wouldn't be happening, and I wouldn't have the material I've got to write these books and to write the columns with. But part of me certainly wishes that were true, because if you're raising a family and you're trying to have a normal life and have your tax dollars being spent on what they're supposed to be spent on and have an honest government, it's a pretty dismal outlook. However, if you're a writer and you're looking for material, it's heaven.
Mm. Well, with all that material out there, how do you make your choices?
Yeah, well, some days it's hard. Some days you just don't know. I mean, it's certainly in terms of the fiction and the novels, you sort of have to weigh it's sort of the plausibility factor. Some of the things that happen down there are beyond what you could ever hope to dream up in fiction. You know, the Ilian Gonzalez story was something that it probably could not be improved upon for the purposes of satire. It was so bizarre and awful on so many levels, and so absurd on so many levels, that it would be a real challenge to write that into a work of fiction and have it and approach the truth, the true facts for weirdness. And there are many, many things like that that happened. Well, the election of 2000, mm-hmm. Al Gore, George W. Bush, all boiling down to the state in which one candidate's brother happens to be the governor, and where most of the people who are supervising the counting of ballots happen to be political appointees. So, it's right out of either Vonnegut or Kafka, depending on your point of view, but it's very, very hard to beat that kind of thing in fiction.
Yeah. On the Gonzalez case, then, that story, what was your take on it for your columns?
Well, I said the same thing over and over again. The kid belongs with his father. You have a little boy here. You have a boy's father who wants him back, a perfectly loving, caring parent who just happens to live in a communist country. And we're not in the business of punishing a parent for their political point of view in our country, but we were perfectly willing to do it to this gentleman for months and months and months, essentially holding his child hostage. And I said again and again, the kid belongs back with his dad. It was a view that a vast majority of Americans shared, according to all the polls I saw, but it was not a view that was widely embraced in certain mm-hmm. elements in Miami and Dade County, obviously, where there's strong feelings, and this became a symbolic sort of thing, to throw in Castro's face. But, it became a debacle in the family that held him, the distant relatives, I might add, who kept Ilian Gonzalez for all those months. These were not exactly, this was not exactly a paradigm of a stable household either. But we were led to believe this was the American dream, and when in fact the kid was being used in the most cynical way by extreme right-wing elements of the community down there, and trotted around, as I said, like a bowling trophy, within days after he's watched his mother perish at sea. It was horrible. It was a horrible thing to watch. And it was a disgrace as far as I was concerned, and I said so in the column again and again and again. My only beef with Janet Reno was that she didn't snatch the kid a lot sooner.
Did you take a lot of heat in the Cuban community?
No. I mean, disagreement doesn't qualify as heat. You got to understand something, that down in Miami, it was a relatively small core of people that were involved in this whole enterprise of keeping this kid away from his dad. And the vast majority of Cuban Americans, while they might have sympathized and understood, were not necessarily out there in the streets, nor were they all in agreement that this was the best way to handle it. So I got a lot of mail from both sides on that issue. But it's certainly a mistake to say that the Cuban American community was unanimous in its support of keeping Ilian here. No, they were not. And there was a lot of mixed feelings about it. There's a lot of folks and a lot of dads and moms who felt torn in that situation. And how would they have felt if their child was being held in a foreign country and not being returned to them for some phonied up political reason? So it was, I the mail I got was mostly pretty, was thoughtful and interesting on both sides of the issue.
Hmm. How did you get your start working as a reporter?
Well, I went to journalism school in the University of Florida and got out and went to work for a small daily in Cocoa, Florida, which was owned by Gannett, another one of those big newspaper chains, and stayed there a couple of years. And I went down to the Herald in Miami, where, I was sort of my hometown. I was born in Fort Lauderdale, and I grew up reading the paper, and I've been there ever since, which is going on 26 years.
Well, Florida's changed a lot in that period of time.
Completely.
Did you have a breakout story in Cocoa?
I don't think so. I mean, I had done a story that was second place in some national award, and I think the Herald, you know, picked up on that and called me. I think that's what happened. I wouldn't call it a breakout story. I mean, I was happy there. I was doing magazine work towards the end there in Coco and writing magazine stories, and quite happy to do that. But also, you know, it was sort of a challenge to be able to go home and see how much it had changed while I was at school, and also to do other kinds of reporting, which I did. I got to do all kinds of stuff in Miami before I started writing the column. So it was, you know, it's all an education. Mm-hmm. That's the one thing about working for newspapers. Every day is different, and some for better or for worse.
Did you always have strong feelings about the environment?
Well, sure. Well, you can't grow up in a place and watch it paved over and not have some sort of strong visceral feelings unless you're dead, you know, unless your soul is dead. You can't sit there and watch a place that you've cared about and been out in the wilderness and spent most of your life outdoors and watched all that vanish and not feel strongly about it and not feel that there isn't a, you know, it isn't worth fighting for. So sure. I don't see how I feel any other way. I mean, you know, I'm not moved to applause every time, I see a new shopping mall go up. I mean, that was sort of, you know, the childhood that I had was, you know, watching something turn from Everglades into, you know, one long big shopping mall. I'm not sure that's a cause for celebration in anybody's childhood.
Mm. Journalist and novelist Carl Hiaasen is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. In addition to being a columnist for the Miami Herald, he's the author of 9 novels. His latest is titled Basket Case. This is The Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. In addition to the novels, Carl Hiaasen is also the author of a book of nonfiction on Disney titled Team Rodent, How Disney Devours the World. You can also read his columns in a couple of collections that have been published, Kick-Ass and Paradise Screwed. You can also find him on the World Wide Web at carlhiaasen.com. His name is spelled H-I-A-A-S-E-N. When did you begin writing fiction?
Well, actually, I started in college, believe it or not. I was at Emory University for a couple of years and the English major there, and a professor said that someone was looking for a sort of a ghostwriter to a doctor was looking for a ghostwriter to work on a novel that he had sort of written himself, and he wanted it polished up and reorganized a little bit. And so I worked on, I did 2 different projects for him, and both of them ended up being published under his name. And it sort of gave me a lot of confidence. I figured if they'd actually gotten published by legitimate New York publishing houses, I maybe stood half a chance. And then I got out of school and went to work in newspapers. I didn't really have much time for outside writing until later, when I went to work on the Herald's investigations team, and for all day long we'd be in up to our elbows in files and reports, mm-hmm. and we weren't writing every day. You know, you write, you work for months, and then you write a whole series of stories. So I had a lot of writing energy that got pent up when I was on the investigations team, and a friend of mine had suggested that some of the stuff we were writing about was interesting enough to have made a novel, and just some sort of a you know, conventional thriller type of novel, and so I ended up doing 3 novels with him. Bill Montalbano was his name. He was a terrific writer, and we essentially started doing that partly because we both loved to write, and we thought it'd be fun, and also because Bill needed a swimming pool. He wanted to make being on newspaper salary, he didn't really have enough saved up. He said, "Do you think we can get enough of an advance on a little novel that I can, you know, put a down payment on a swimming pool?" I said, "Well, let's give it a try." So we wrote 5 chapters of a book that became Powder Burn was the title of the book when it was published. But our agent sold it in like a couple of weeks, and we both looked at each other and said, "Oh my God, now we got to finish it." And we did, and we ended up doing 3 books together. All of them sort of lifted from notebooks and our own reporting experiences in Florida, and in Bill's case, in China. and it was fun. And then after that, I started writing on my own with Tourist Season. It was the first novel I ever did by myself and put my name on it.
He got the swimming pool, I take it.
He got his swimming pool. Yes, he did.
Very good. Let's talk with a listener on line one in Champaign. Hi.
Hi. I'm always interested in character development in novels, and you have some of the most quirky and enjoyable characters. And I was wondering, are they your invention, or do you encounter such people regularly in your job as reporter?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think the answer is both. I've met certainly a lot of true life characters who I've borrowed a trait from or a quirk from and worked them into a new character of my own in the novels. And occasionally you'll meet a real life character just overwhelms you. In Basket Case, there's an episode where Jack is forced to defend himself with a big frozen lizard that he keeps in his freezer, in his refrigerator, and he's forced to defend himself against an intruder with that. And it would seem to be a pretty bizarre and twisted concept, but that came from real life. That's a fellow I know in the Keys who for several years kept a big dead lizard in his freezer for all kinds of complicated reasons and intended to use it for self-defense, believe it or not. So I wish I could say my imagination was wild enough to make it all up, but that was actually true.
Well, that's one, I suppose, advantage of living in a quirky environment. The people rise to the occasion.
That's for sure.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for calling.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. There are some great characters in this book. One of them is a guy by the name of L'Oreal.
Mm-hmm. He's sort of a would-be record producer. When Jimmy Stoma, the faded-away rock star, passes away, his widow is a sort of an up-and-coming, you know, rock diva, MTV rock diva, and she uses the occasion of Jimmy's funeral to launch her new CD. She plays it for the assembled mourners, which is just about par for the course in that world. And she has a producer who claims to produce a lot of bands, although his credentials are shaky. And he's just renamed himself L'Oreal after the hair product that he uses on his tremendous mane of red hair. And that's really the best he can come up with on short notice. But it's very important to have like one name in some worlds, you know, Cher, Madonna. That's sort of how he was thinking about it.
Yeah, that one name thing.
Yeah, that one name thing. It doesn't help him much in the end of the novel, but it gets him going.
Yeah, and now we have folks who just want to be known by symbols rather than names. And how is it that you came up with this name for this publishing group?
Well, I pronounce it actually Maggid Feast.
Maggid Feast, okay.
And that's sort of self-explanatory.
Yeah, I was reading it. I was thinking of Maggid
Fest right.
Myself.
Well, I just was trying to come up with something with a little bit of that resonated with a greed and a good bit of disrepute. And so that's the hyphenated ownership syndrome.
Yeah. Maggid Feast.
The Maggid Feast Publishing Group.
CEO Race Maggid III.
Right, fondly known as Master Race.
Master Race, yes. That's Jack's name for him. Let's talk with another listener in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm from New York, and if you've been to Times Square recently, you've seen sort of Walt Disney World reproduced. I wondered if you'd talk a little bit about your book about Walt Disney, and I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Okay. Well, in Team Rodent, which was a nonfiction, they just asked me to do some sort of long, you know, rant, and it's a short book. It's a thin book, but I opened the book, in Times Square, talking about sort of the Disneyfication of Times Square, and it sort of opens with a lament for sleaze. I mean, I think there is a place for sleaze in society, and to see it sort of exterminated Disney style was a little disheartening. So I open it in some sleazy porn store in Times Square and sort of take it running from there. But there's something in sort of the centerpiece of that whole book is what's happened in Florida as a result of Disney, and that is they've imported this theme park, which could be anywhere in the world, and is, you know, it's in Japan, Paris, Anaheim, you name it. The Disney experiences could take place anywhere, and they've come to one of the prettiest places in the planet, Florida, and sort of superimposed it in Central Florida, and it's changed everything about, you know, the culture. and some for better, some for worse. You know, Orlando is now one of the most crowded, congested, you know, tackified places. You know, wall-to-wall suburbs and you know, fast food joints, and it's really it's an astonishing thing. And then when you get to Disney, it's all nice and tranquil and organized and planned out. And but what no one accounts for is the sort of the after effect of bringing in 40 million people a year, which is what Disney basically attracts in Florida. 40 million people, and it's basically inviting the entire population of France to trample through your state and not leave any you know, debris in their wake, which is of course impossible. And it's affected us greatly. So I'm not a big fan of theirs for a lot of reasons. And so that's sort of where the book came from.
Team Roden, How Disney Devours the World. I was in high school or just out of high school, and a girlfriend and I went to Orlando. This was years ago. And it was amazing even then, the difference between what the situation was outside the Magic Kingdom and what life was like on the inside. Although while we were there, someone got murdered inside the Magic Kingdom, which was, for a 17, 18-year-old kid, was a little distressing.
Yeah, well, they've had a lot of incidents in there. And part of what I deal with in the book is their so-called police department, which is, or their public safety department, which are not really cops, but they act like it. And they've had some disturbing incidents there, and disturbing incidents involving employees as well. So, and of course, they're control freaks, and that's what they're known for. And the information is tough to get, but we'd written a fair amount about it, and I'd written about it in the past. So I was able to get into some clips and to, you know, really get into some of the things that have happened. And the image that's portrayed, the Disney culture, which is wonderful for kids, and there's no denying that kids have a fantastic time when they go there. My son certainly did when he was little. Mm-hmm. But what they present to the world is not exactly the same culture with which they deal with their own employees, and or do they deal with stuff that happens on the property. I mean, they've got as cold-blooded a bunch of attorneys as you'll ever see. And it's a much different culture when you get in the corporate level, and it's and there's a fair amount of hypocrisy involved too. And it was all quite entertaining to write about, because there was all kinds of little stories that they'd rather you not know about it. But it's also, getting back to what the gentleman said again, it's this sort of this idea that they know best, and whether it's in Times Square or whether it's in Florida, where they decided, for example, that the lakes weren't blue enough in Orlando for their postcard purposes, so they scraped out the lakes and took away the trees, which deposited the tannic coloring in the water, so that the lakes would be nice and blue and make the tourists happy. In other words, nature is not even good enough for them. Forget about Times Square. Nature doesn't even measure up to what Disney standards are, and they just completely redo it in their own image of what it ought to look like for promotional purposes. And there's something obscene about that.
How are things in the Everglades these days?
Well, we'll see. They've got a lot of money put aside to try to fix the Everglades, and now the big battle is over who gets all the water they're going to save. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not enough that we save it because it's the right thing to do. There has to be an economic incentive, and in this case, developers need water to continue their work in South Florida, to continue building and paving and putting up condos, and cities need the water, and big agriculture, the sugar industry, cattle, they all need the water. So now there'll be a big fight, a big ugly fight about who gets the water that we're saving ostensibly from Mother Nature. And that's where you'll see the political wheeling dealing. It's already going on, and it's going to be a mess for many years, I suspect.
Hmm. In your career, have you ever come close to being sent into an exile like the protagonist of Basket Case?
No, and God knows I've tried. No, I haven't. I've been very, very lucky, and both with my reporting career and the work on the investigations team, which was tremendously rewarding, and then as writing the column, as I have since 1985, I've got to say they completely leave me alone. I've never had a column killed. I've never been told to lay off anybody. I've never been censored or criticized or in any public way by the management. And I know I've caused them all manner of grief, because I've ticked off a lot of important, or I should say prominent people in South Florida and elsewhere. and they leave me alone, which is the best thing you can say about any newspaper management, is that if they leave you alone, that's the greatest job in the world.
Yeah. Who owns the Miami Herald?
Knight Ridder does.
Knight Ridder.
Big newspaper
chain.
Yeah.
Well, that's heartening, isn't it?
Well, it is. Yeah, I'll see if I have a job by the time I get home.
Now, I did go to the paper's website to read your columns, and I noticed that when you finish the book, you're going to go from doing two columns to one column a week.
Just for this year, I think we're going to try it, because I've got a lot of promotional work to do for this novel, and I'm actually finishing another novel at the same time, a novel for kids. And so with all that going on, I just decided this year to try to cut back and do one a week. And also, I'd like to get reacquainted with my family. I think I have two kids at home. I'm not sure.
Yeah, that's the important thing.
Yeah.
This novel for kids, it's a novel, then it must, I'm assuming then it's for a little bit of an older reader, like what they call a young reader.
Yeah, 10 to 14 is, I think, the target group. And this is new to me, so I'm not exactly sure about that. But, I mean, it's been fun. I've really, really enjoyed it. But it's certainly a different, you know, I mean, obviously the language that the grown-ups use is going to have to be cleaned up a little. I can't have the bad guys necessarily talking the way they do in real life for kids, and I wouldn't want them to. I have nieces and a nephew and a stepson who are all future readers of mine, I hope, and they're always asking to read my grown-up novels, and this is, I'm hoping to have something I can hand them and not be too worried about that kind of stuff. As a parent, I mean, I'm as concerned as anybody about that.
I'll have to wait to read about the slut puppies later.
Yeah, the slut puppies will be a little older for
me. A little older reading group.
Yeah.
Well, are you trying what you're writing out on the kids?
I'm going to let my stepson, I think, look at it. I'm almost done. I'm sort of in the editing phase now, so he's taking a first pass at it, and I'm sure I'll get a very frank and candid review. That's the terrific thing about kids. They're a lot more succinct and to the point than most book reviewers are.
Yeah. And will this be a funny novel?
Yeah, and I hope so. Yeah. I mean, I hope it's going to be funny, and it's going to be suspenseful too, and it just gets fun. One of the kids is a runaway, and the other is a boy who's new, who's just moved to Florida from Montana and really doesn't have any friends yet. And they sort of hook up in a little of adventure. But it is, I hope it's going to be kind of amusing. We'll see. You know, again, it's this new territory for me, but I am having a good time with it.
Yeah, well, between the novel for kids and Basket Case and the Warren Zevon collaboration, it sounds like you're having a pretty good time. I just hope that you'll get home soon.
I do too, yeah, and so does my wife. But now it's been great. I told you earlier, I mean, I've really lucked out. I've had the chance to write novels that make people laugh and at the same time, you know, get my licks and get off on these riffs about things that I think are important. And also with the newspaper columns, I have the luxury of being able to write about pretty much whatever I want and not be bothered or pestered by any big corporate fist. And that's a rare thing, too, and I do feel fortunate.
We've got one caller left waiting to talk with us this afternoon, so let's go and talk with this listener in Decatur on line one. But it'll have to be quick, everybody. Okay, listener in Decatur, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Just thank you so much for many hours of pleasure. And my test of reality is it stranger than a Carl Hiaasen novel? And many times reality is these days. So thank you.
Thank you for saying it. It is. It's getting harder and harder to stay ahead of the curve, I can promise you.
Well, thanks to the listener for joining us this afternoon. And Carl Hiaasen, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Well, thank you so much. Thanks a lot, Celeste.
Take care. Carl Hiaasen has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. His latest novel is Basket Case. He's the author of 9 novels. His previous novels include Sick Puppy, Striptease, and Double Whammy. He's also the author of a book of nonfiction on Disney titled Team Rodent. And you can read his columns. There have been a couple of collections published, Kick-Ass and Paradise Screwed. His new novel, Basket Case, is published by Knopf, and you can find him on the web at carlhiaasen.com, HIAASEN.